evening and thanks for tuning in. This is CKLN 88.1 FM. The name of the show is the Word of Mouth News show that comes to you every day of the week. And this is the Friday edition. My name is Susie Alvarez, and sorry about the delay. We had some transportation problems, but we're finally here. It's a very special show. Today, we're not going to have any headlines. We were planning on playing for you a radio documentary that we produced specifically for today, and that is in honor of May Day. Tomorrow is May Day, and there's a couple of events happening in the city. One of them is the March for Status for All at 1 p.m., which will commence at St. Jamestown, Wellesley Street, and Ontario Street. This is the fifth annual May Day of Action organized by No One Is Illegal and many other organizations, and you should come out. We will be there, people from CKLN, as well as many other organizations that are very active in the city. For more information, you can always Google No One Is Illegal Toronto, and you can get details about the march, where people are gathering, and what will be the route, so that if you cannot join us at the rally, you can at least add yourself up to the long, long, long line of hundreds and thousands of people that will be marching tomorrow. The march starts at 1 p.m., and as I said, there's more details at actually www.noelisillegal.org. And then there's another action that is taking place tomorrow as well, in observance of International Workers' Day, May Day. And that's going to take place at 1 p.m. as well at Bathurst and St. Clair. And there will be a cultural event following the rally and the march. And that will take place at 3 p.m. at the Witchwood Barns, which is located at 601 Christie Street, south of St. Clair. And for that, you can visit www.may-1.org. So lots of stuff happening tomorrow, lots of great things in observance of May Day, and at various locations in the city. And if you cannot attend one, maybe you can attend the other. So let's kick it over to the documentary. This is a 25-minute piece that we produced, which features voices of marchers who attended last year May Day of Action, which was organized by No One Is Illegal Toronto, Mujeres al Frente, SAURO, Migrante Ontario, Canadian Heart, Casa Salvador Allende, Basics Newsletter, OCAP, Jane and Finch Action Against Poverty, the Sikh Activist Network, the Toronto New Socialist, Barrio Nuevo, the Stop Community Food Center, the Bayan Toronto People, PCLS, OPERC Toronto, CAIA, and the GGAPSS. As I said, you're about to listen to voices of marchers and representatives from a diverse group of organizations that attended the May Day of Action. And in these 25 minutes, you'll hear about their thoughts on Canadian immigration policy, and why do they come out on May Day and support this very important march and rally. So let's turn it over to the documentary. As I say it, you are tuning into CKLN 88.1 FM. My name is Susie Alvarez, and here is the documentary. Enjoy.
Of
2009, thousands of people took to the streets of Toronto to demand status for all, armed with chants, banners, and a strong commitment to justice and dignity for all. People representing diverse communities and groups raised their voices to demand the end of criminalization, exclusion, and oppression of people without status, refugees, migrant workers, poor people, people of color, and immigrants living and working in this country. This May Day of Action was the result of impressive coordinating efforts by a coalition of groups working in Toronto, which includes No One is Illegal Toronto, Mujeres al Frente, SAWRO, Migrante Ontario, Canadian Heart, Casa Salvador Allende, Basics Newsletter, the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty, the Jane and Finch Action Against Poverty, the Sikh Activist Network, Toronto New Socialists, Barrio Nuevo, the Stop Community Food Center, Bayan Toronto, the PCLS, Oper Toronto, Kaya, and the GGAPSS. On this overcast Saturday, the rain and strong winds did not deter but propel participants at this rally and march to move forward and move strong along the busy streets of the downtown Toronto core in support of dignity and justice for all migrants, their allies, and all those who are victimized by a racist, capitalist, and colonialist system that imposes controls over who can stay and who should go, a system that draws borders and orders who can cross and who must turn back. Along with the thousands of demonstrators, grassroots media workers took to the streets and joined the march to cover this historic event. The following is an audio documentation of voices and opinions present and participant at this May Day of Action. Representatives from various organizations, communities, and groups spoke out and about Canada's immigration policies, the present top-down economic crisis, and the struggle for dignity and respect for all migrants living in the city and country. These are their voices. These are their words. What's your name and the name of the group you're with?
Okay, my name is Nehama Miller, and I'm the president of the National Council of Latin American Women, Latinas.
And why are you here today?
Okay, we're here, first of all, because we're celebrating May Day, which is a very big a holiday in our countries. And second of all, we like to see the left more united in Toronto. It's good to see political spaces being occupied by different standpoints and different trends. Ours is a group which is looking to have a political voice before the Canadian Parliament with respect to many Latin American issues.
What do you think of the economic crisis, and how have you seen it affect you or your community?
I'm a political economist and a political philosopher, so I could give you a very long explanation about it. But it's the crisis is something that, for example, I in my writings predicted would happen quite a few years ago. It's not a surprise. It is affecting the communities at very different levels, depending upon the social class of the persons. Notably, for people in the middle class or with the higher incomes, they're probably going to be losing a lot of their consumerist habits, because they're going to be losing a lot of their possessions. For the working classes, it's going to mean a reconfiguration of political strategies.
What do you think of Canada's immigration policy?
Canada has quite an abysmal record in the way it has been treating political refugees from other countries, and that's the main issue we have been working with respect to Colombia, which is my home country. With respect to migrant workers, Canada will eventually have to change its policies, mainly because as our human values become more prevalent than the values which were within the bourgeois regime, then they will come to realize that if McDonald's has a corporate right to open up factories in our countries, the workers have the right to come here, and it shouldn't be a question of why or what. It's just Turtle Island was Turtle Island, and the Americas was one before all this colonialism started.
Eterno, unido, jamás será vencido.
Justice,
justice! We want justice! 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 We want justice!
What's your name and what group are you with today?
My name is Mohammed.
What do you think of Canada's immigration policy?
It's not fair, you know. We have to change, you know. It's not for everybody, you know. It's fair.
What do you think of the economic crisis and how have you seen it affect you and your community?
Affect me, you know. Also my friends, you know. So I hope we're going to get well soon.
You're also with what?
Yeah.
What's your name?
Tim Biden.
What do you think of Canada's immigration policy?
I think the problem with the immigration policy is they're still too-based on
pretty
strong people here. And rather than we should be celebrating and welcoming people from all over the world, because that makes our own country better. It makes us a better place to live. We should embrace that and welcome it. But still, so much of our policies are based on fear, and people haven't tried to live themselves more than they need.
What are your opinions about the economic crisis?
I think it's been a long time in coming. I think we need to look at this crisis as who's been benefiting for the last 10, 20 years, and who's the ones who are bearing the cost of fixing this crisis. And clearly it's not there. But those who have been benefiting, wealthy corporations need to be the ones who pay the price to get it back.
Why do you think it was important for the Workers Action Center to be here today and take part in the march?
I think it's important for the Workers Action Center to be here because we are working with people across the city who are facing working conditions that are made incredibly more difficult when they're denied immigration status. It means that people are forced to put up with violations of their rights. They're forced to accept wages below the minimum wage. They're forced to allow bad bosses to continue. Those kinds of violations, and when we organize with non-status workers, we see that those challenges in speaking up for your rights are there, but we know that the membership of the Workers Action Center supports all of us having access to decent working conditions across the city, and that's why our fight for better wages and working conditions has to be connected to the fight for status for all workers in the city and across Canada.
Association
legal landed immigrants to settle here. And I know that it becomes so much harder for somebody who doesn't have status. And I think it's really pointless the way they treat people who don't have status. So I'm here to show my solidarity. And I'm here on behalf of the part-time union, because I think that everybody has a right to settle here. Everybody has a right to access employment here, decent employment here. Everybody has a right to access education here. And last year at U of T, there was a case of a student who was deported to Bangladesh, and that really got me thinking that education isn't supposed to be taken for granted, and that we as students have a responsibility to ensure that everybody has a place at the university, whether or not they have status. So that's probably why I'm here.
What do you think of Canada's immigration policy?
In two words, it sucks. Seriously, it sucks. I think it's blatantly racist. I think it discriminates. It has a long history of being racist and discriminating against people of color. What makes all of this so sad and what makes the struggle really inspiring is because this has happened for as long as we can remember. Canada is a country of immigrants, and from as far back as we look, people of color have been discriminated against as part of the immigration policies. I think this is just a way to show people, in particular people from developing countries, people of color, that they're good enough to work, but they're not good enough to stay. And I think as an immigrant, I fell to the rough end of that myself. My parents had, came here as legal landed immigrants, but even they were literally put through the ringer. They had to get re-qualified. Their qualifications were recognized. They were working at entry-level positions. So I very personally identify with the struggle of immigrants and refugees. Maybe my own are not as extreme, but I think I certainly can stand in solidarity with them.
Justice! Justice! We want justice! 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 We want justice! Queremos justicia!
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 Queremos justicia!
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 Are you doing? Yeah! Let me hear you say justicia now! Yeah! Justicia now!
Justicia now!
Justicia now! Well, Chris, why are those migrant agriculture workers? How come they're not here? Why aren't you giving greetings from them to everybody? Today, I want to say to you that the workers are showing their support. They're working right now, and we want to send a message of support to them.
Yeah!
I'm going to read you a list of these cities and the areas where these migrant workers work, and each time you say justice now. Bradford! Vienna! Burford! Cortland! Simcoe!
Justice now!
Timber!
Justice now!
Delhi!
Justice now!
Exeter!
Justice now!
Kingsville!
Justice now!
Wheatley!
Justice now!
Virgil!
Justice now!
Jordan Station!
Justice now!
Guardia!
Justice now!
Shrewsbury!
Justice now!
So some
times to the community. When you see action doesn't work, this is a reason why action works, because people mobilize, they agitate, and they fight back. How do you all feel about Minister Kenny? Who likes Minister Kenny here? I can't hear you. Let me say it. What do you think of Minister Kenny? Well, I have the pleasure to announce that Minister Kenny trashed Justicia for migrant workers in the paper today. He said it, that when we demand anti-racial profiling of migrant workers, we were ridiculous. We said the hell with him, the House of the Immigration Laws, and we said the House of the Tories. Woo! I guess in closing, one of the things we want to do to everybody here is to talk about what we need to do. We also need to address and say what needs to be stopped. There are many myths about migrant workers that we need to address. Number one, migrant workers aren't taking Canadian jobs. Number two, migrants aren't driving down wages. Number three, migrants aren't taking away, making our working conditions set and safe. Migrant workers are also not unskilled, as the government says. Migrant workers don't want to join unions. Those are all lies. Those are all lies said by the employers and government officials. And I'm here to say from the workers that they're going to continue to fight and fight to win. And in closing, what we have to do is remember our histories, remember our communities. I know that each one of these migrant workers come from places where fight blocs are active. We draw strength from these workers and will continue to work to fight to end injustices, fight to end irrespective of what they say and how they do. Justice and dignity for all workers, justice and dignity for migrant workers. Solidarity now!
Workplace.
What do you think of Canada's immigration policy?
I think it's not fair, unjust, it's racist, exploitative.
And the economic crisis, what's your opinion on that and how have you seen it affect your life and the life of your community?
Keeps the immigrant community in a constant economic crisis. It'll keep us poor and keep them exploited and hard working, and then same time keep the economic elites who are often not of color in cushy lifestyles while the immigrant communities are suffering. It's just disgusting, the immigration system here. They're saying all these amendments they're trying to sugarcoat it and make it seem like they're trying to be friendly with the immigrant community and they're not going to let people in because they're saying there's not a lot of work here. But the truth is they're still going to let immigrants in, but as undocumented workers or temporary workers, so less rights and more easily exploitable. So definitely just using the economic crisis as a guise and as an excuse to be able to be more easily exploit immigrants.
My name is Seema Sahar Zerahi, and I'm a national representative with Human Rights, Equity and Diversity at United Food and Commercial Workers of Canada.
Why
why did you guys come and take part of the march today?
UCW Canada has been advocating for the rights of migrant workers for over a decade now. We know that it's very important to work hand-in-hand with immigrant communities, refugee communities, temporary foreign workers, and migrant communities to fight the injustices in the Canadian immigration system. So we're here because immigrant rights are workers' rights. We're here because we know that nobody should be cheap and disposable form of labor, and that everybody should be able to come to Canada as a permanent resident.
What do you think of Canada's immigration policy, and what do you think needs to change?
Well, we know that Canada's immigration policy is extremely discriminatory, particularly against workers, particularly against people of lower incomes, against racialized communities, and these are all the inequalities that have to be challenged, that have to be resisted, and have to be changed.
What do you think of the economic crisis, and how have you seen it affect you, your group, or your community?
Well, we've certainly seen a backlash against immigrant workers and migrant workers in light of the economic crisis. The same companies that created the economic downfall are now turning to these workers and blaming them and pitting one group of workers against another group of workers. So we're extremely concerned that our workers' rights are going to be further disenfranchised in the light of the economic crisis.
No one is illegal!
Stop the border people!
No one is illegal!
Organizations here from the Tamil community, especially the Tamil youth organization. That's one of the main co-organizers for this event.
And why did you come to today's march?
The reason why we came is that, you know, today's a day to actually show and demonstrate international solidarity, whether it be workers' rights, whether it be human rights, whatever it may be. You know, it's a good avenue for us to all address our issues. And right now, a lot of people are aware of the fact that the Tamils are undergoing a genocidal war, and we're actually here to also promote awareness on that and, you know, call out for more solidarity and also be standing right by each other's side with other migrant issues as well.
How is that affecting your community?
Well, here, obviously, there's a lot of layoffs because, you know, we are, like, also one of those communities that are, you know, subject to precarious status. You know, a lot of our temporary workers and, you know, taking care of, like, low-paying jobs and so on. So we are definitely one of those people who are victims of it. And also, our community is undergoing depression because of the whole issue, not only just because of the jobs, losing jobs, but also the fact that there's a genocide going on. So there's, like, it's a really bad time for our community at this point.
So what do you think of Canada's treatment of refugees and immigrants? What of their immigration policy?
To be honest, Canada should not take pride in calling themselves a multicultural, diverse society, because they don't, when it really comes down to, you know, talking the walk, they don't do it. You know, they don't treat us right, they don't listen to us unless, you know, like, we're going to put in the votes, you know, we're going to be voting in the ballots, right? And Canada really needs to step up on their game. And I think the first step for them to do what, for them, you know, important and advance as a community would be to address the native indigenous struggle first and, like, you know, adhere to their rights. And then, you know, obviously, I think we would get our rights also being respected, because if they're not going to respect the people who really rightfully own this land, they're not going to respect people who are going to be here, all, you know, along with them as settlers.
Arguments are not going to attract people. Winning is going to attract people.
Radio. The Poor People's Riot, as they call it, was necessary, it was reasonable, and it was just.
Radio.
And if you get in my way to make sure that that man gets housing, or that he gets enough to eat, I will move you.
Radio.
Welcome to the OCAP show. You're listening to 88.1 CKLN FM. Tonight on tech, we have Mark Brill and his host, myself, Sarah Vance. Our focus tonight, immigrant rights. We start with a look at the present, immigrant issues, police brutality, and racism, as they've played out in the case of Freddy Villanueva of Montreal and his older brother, Danny. We end with a look toward the future. Immigration law is slated to change this coming Monday, as Bill C-11 is likely to be passed. But what's it all about? And how is it likely to affect people? A word of warning, it isn't pretty. First, the present. In August 2008, a Montreal police officer shot and killed Freddy Villanueva, then 18 years old, and wounded two other youth of color during an altercation in a Montreal park. 2 years later, the issue has now come to a coroner's inquest in which the police conduct is being looked at, though not criminally. In the meantime, Freddie's brother, also a key witness in the case, is now facing deportation as he's been found to be criminally inadmissible to Canada after living here since he was 12 years old. He's now 23. We're going to go to an interview with Jaggi Singh from Montreal, a Montreal-based activist, a member of No One Is Illegal Montreal, and someone who's been working with the family and around this case for some time. Hi, Jaggi. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir. I can hear you. Hi.
Hi. So, first off, can you tell us a little bit about if there's any updates in this case, first of all?
Well, the most recent update is the fact that the Immigration Refugee Board decided in a very short 5-minute hearing that Danny Villanueva is inadmissible to Canada because he has a criminal conviction and was in prison for more than 6 months, and he is therefore subject to removal. He won't be deported anytime soon because his lawyer immediately launched an appeal of that decision. And the other piece of news is that the coroner's inquest into the circumstances surrounding the death of Freddie, Danny's younger brother, is going to go forward next week, and Danny Villanueva is going to continue his testimony. Clearly, doing either one of those things, that is, testifying at a coroner's inquest into the death of your brother, or going through removal proceedings, are, on their own terms, very, very difficult, to say the least. Danny's dealing with both, and that's the most recent update. He's going to testify at the coroner's inquest this coming Monday.
Can you tell us why this case is being heard through a coroner's inquiry instead of a criminal trial?
Well, the incidents of August 9, 2008, when as you mentioned, police officers shot and killed Freddy Villanueva and also injured two other youth, was investigated by an outside police force, the Sûreté du Québec. And their investigation, as is emerging at the coroner's inquest, was flawed. It was biased in favor of the police. And based on their investigation and based on looking at the evidence of that investigation by a Crown attorney, they decided not to pursue any sort of criminal charges against the police. The coroner's inquest was put forward, I think, to satiate the fact that a wide variety of people in Montreal, there was a groundswell of critique and of anger at how Freddie was killed. It was meant to satiate that. But a coroner's inquest is not empowered, clearly, to deal with any criminal matters, but also it's not empowered to get to the heart of this matter. It's meant to look at why Freddie was killed, but many people have spoken about the aspect of racial and social profiling, and it's not clear that this inquiry is equipped to deal with that. So we have a coroner's inquest because no police officers have been charged in the death of Freddie.
As I understand it, too, I believe that a coroner's inquest in Quebec works very similarly to one in Ontario. And in Ontario, even if one does get some positive recommendations that come out, they're not even binding against a police force. They don't have to be enacted.
Exactly. It's it has the gloss of being an investigation or an inquiry, but it's very limited. That being said, I think that the police and their police union and others that want to defend the police aren't very happy at the fact that the inquiry has been effectively used by lawyers for the family and supporters of the family who have standing at the inquiry to expose the double standard in the police investigation, for example, and to expose other things at the inquiry.
Can you give us a sense of what the statistics are like around killings by police? Is this an aberration? Is this pretty typical? What is the degree to which police killings do seem to be racially motivated?
Well, since 1987, and we refer back to 1987 because that was the year that Anthony Griffin, a black youth, was shot and killed in Montreal, and that provoked a huge amount of outrage at the time against police impunity and police violence. So since 1987, we can estimate that there have been 43 police killings in Montreal, although currently people who are involved in anti-police brutality organizing in Montreal are doing more research, and I think we're going to be upping that statistic to about 60. There are an awful lot of cases that don't make the media where the police are involved in a killing in unusual circumstances. So there have been 43 police killings for sure since 1987. If you just look at some of the more recent cases, the case of Freddie Villanueva in August of 2008, the case of Guilhem Registre, of Haitian background, who was killed after receiving 6 taser charges by the Montreal police in 2008 as well, and the case of Mohamed Anas Benes, who was killed by Montreal police in 2005. In all 3 cases, you have members of visible minorities, people who were in immigrant-based neighborhoods, Montréal-Nord, Côte-de-Neige, and Saint-Michel, and you have what is an element of racial profiling. Now, clearly, of those 43 people who've been killed, not all are visible minorities. You have people who are poor, people who are marginalized in other ways, with mental health issues or other things, but you don't have police killings happening in middle-class or rich neighborhoods in Montreal. You have people who are both racially and socially profiled otherwise who end up being the victims of this brutality. And what we're also saying is impunity, because after the killing itself, you see that the police have impunity to get away with it, because rarely, if ever, is anyone charged, as we've seen in the 3 recent cases of Guilhem Registre, Mohamed Anas Benes, and Freddie Villanueva, and as we see in the scope of 43 people who've been killed in the last 2 decades or so.
So if we go back to Danny for a second, I noticed that known as Legal Montreal on your website, you talk about Danny's case as receiving a double punishment. What does that mean?
Well, Danny is facing removal because he has a criminal record that rules him inadmissible. That's a double punishment because it's not as if Danny hasn't done the punishment and done the time for the crime that he committed. And he's being doubly punished because he is now facing removal to Honduras, a country that he left at the age of 12. That is fundamentally discriminatory and unfair, and it amounts to a double punishment. It reveals to us, and no one's legal, the inherent racism within the Immigration and Refugee Protection Act. Putting aside the circumstances of why Danny got a criminal record, the fact is he did the punishment. He assumed the responsibility for what he did. And there's absolutely no reason why we could justify further punishing him for a crime he's already done time for, except for some recourse to a double standard whereby a migrant doesn't quite have the same rights as somebody who's born here.
Yeah, I think, and it even goes beyond that, too, in the sense that I believe that oftentimes the public has a perception that people are only declared inadmissible if they've been found guilty of really particularly heinous crimes. Not that that should happen either, because it still constitutes a double punishment. But what is the law actually like? What do people get declared inadmissible for?
Well, you make a good point, because those heinous crimes, say, that get a lot of attention are the ones that are used to justify the fact that the people are getting convicted for shoplifting, say, are getting convicted for passing counterfeit money. As we know, and what we need to do here is demystify criminality. As we know, people who come from poor backgrounds, from marginalized backgrounds, when people are dealing with social pressure and anxiety and the rest of it, which happens in immigrant communities, you end up making mistakes, to put it euphemistically, and you might end up with a criminal record. That doesn't make you a serious criminal. That doesn't make you someone who has heinous values. But nonetheless, the law overstretches itself and stigmatizes and makes many people face removal, even in cases where people have lived here for a decade or 2 decades. There's a real reality here a reality here in Montreal where youth of visible minority background, immigrant youth, who came here when they were kids, when they were in their teens, face removal to a country which they haven't seen since they were a kid because of a crime they might have committed, and that's fundamentally unfair.
We don't have a lot of time left, but I guess when I look at this case, I think, you know, it's been in the media, not a lot, but it's been in the media, and it looks pretty bad in the midst of, you know, here's this kid, he's 18 years old, he gets killed by the police, two other kids get shot, the inquiry is finally going on, in the midst of the thing, here's this guy who's lived almost all of his life in Canada, who's going to get deported, who's being declared criminally inadmissible, even though he's one of the key witnesses. It looks rough. I wonder, why do you think the Canadian government thinks they can get away with this kind of thing? How does it speak to Canadian politics?
Well, with Danny's case, one thing that's happened out of it is we are beginning to speak about this reality of double punishment. And in doing so, what we're learning is that there's a lot of shame and stigma attached to people in communities who might have somebody who's been convicted of a crime and facing removal. What we need to do is remove that stigma. So the government is able to get away with it because grassroots groups and movements and people working with families aren't able to speak out effectively at how fundamentally discriminatory and racist this provision of the criminal code is. A woman from the Maison d'Etat spoke about so many cases that she knew about, of Haitian youth who were convicted of a crime and therefore ruled inadmissible, had never seen or been in Haiti since the age of 4 or 5, say. And she says people don't speak out because there's a stigma attached to it. So I think if we can, as we do in any movement, break the fear, break the isolation, break those stigmas, break that shame, and speak out, we can effectively fight back, because the government gets away with it because there isn't that fight back. The government gets away with it because we speak about these heinous cases, which are the exceptions, and don't speak about the reality of what actually happens with this inadmissibility provision in the Immigration and Refugee Protection Act.
Thank you, Jaggi. Just to quickly close up, obviously this is a huge issue in Toronto as well, and we're talking about a specific case in Montreal, but if people want to support the Villanueva case, what can they do?
Well, I'll answer that in two ways. One is, this issue of double punishment, clearly, as you're alluding to, is something that we see in every major urban center in Canada. So we need to build a movement against this. We need to bring this issue out in the forefront. As I said, we need to break the fear and stigma attached to this issue. So that's one thing, because there are plenty of these cases that are going on in Toronto, as I'm sure you know. And we need to sort of build unity there, because that will help Danny's case. That will help, because that's fundamental to his case, is double punishment. But on a more short-term basis, in terms of supporting the Villanueva family, it's putting pressure on Vic Taves, the Minister of Public Security, and Jason Kenney, the Minister of Immigration. It might seem a bit futile because we write those letters all the time, but that parallel with building this campaign with grassroots groups to denounce a double punishment is key. And we have some openings. The Fédération Défense de Québec has denounced double punishment. The Canadian Union of Postal Workers at the national level has denounced as double punishment. As we begin to hear more about actual cases and who these youth are, and begin to see they're not people that we can abstract away from our communities, but they're part of our communities. They're our neighbors, they're our schoolmates, they're our workmates. I think we can effectively fight double punishment, and doing so help the Villanueva family deal with this particular injustice that they're facing, in addition to the fact that their other son, Freddie, was shot and killed by the Montreal police.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Sarah.
You're welcome. Okay, we're moving right along next, getting ready to gear up for the May Day, known as Illegal March for Status, that happens tomorrow. We're going to be speaking next to a representative from Known as Illegal named Mohan Mishra. We'll be speaking to him in just a minute, but in case you don't have the details about that march, it's happening tomorrow afternoon, that's Saturday afternoon, 1 o'clock, with people meeting at St. Jamestown, and that's at Wellesley and Ontario Streets. If you have mobility issues and you want to come and join, there's a wheelchair access bus that's going to be leaving at 12:30 in the afternoon from the northeast corner of Bloor and Yonge. So the subway subway station there is wheelchair accessible. And you can join us at 12:30 northeast corner of Bloor and Yonge to get on the wheelchair access bus. So that's 1 o'clock tomorrow afternoon, St. Jamestown, Wellesley, and Ontario Streets. So we're going to have Mohan Mishra in just a nanosecond, I hope, talking to us from Known as Illegal. And he's going to give us a bit of sense of what's to come, namely Bill C-11. Looks like it's destined to be passed in all likelihood this coming Monday and come into law. It's a change to immigration law and policy. It's brought in under Jason Kenney, who's now become somewhat infamous for his policies and quotable quotes around what he thinks about immigrants and immigration system in Canada. I believe we now have Mohan with us. I can't hear what's being said to me. There's mouthing. Maybe, maybe not. Yes, we're ready to go.
Great.
Oh, hi. You don't sound like Mohan.
I'm Faria.
Hi, Faria. Thanks for joining
How are
us.
You?
I'm good. So first up, I'm sure lots of people listening have no idea what we're talking about right now. We don't have a lot of time left, but could you give us just like the Cole's Notes version? What is Bill C-11? Why should we care?
Sure. So Bill C-11 is basically the Conservative government, in particular Jason Kenney, who's the immigration of citizenship. His idea of what our immigration system and refugee termination system should really look like. And what's happening, just in a very short snippet to give you an idea, is that one of their justifications for Bill C-11, and this is important because of what actually ends up being included in Bill C-11, has been this idea and rhetoric that's been really widespread, particularly in the media, smear campaigns against migrants and refugee groups. Have been that somehow Canada's asylum system is, you know, just absolutely crippled by these long delays and this cumbersome process whereby we have these, you know, illegitimate and so-called bogus refugee claimants who are just taking advantage of our all too benevolent system. And so Bill C-11 came about with this kind of media messaging that, you know, immigrants are really taking advantage of our system. And what was proposed was that we should actually take this so-called cumbersome process and completely dismantle it. So just to give you an idea of what this dismantling looks like, one of the things that's been happening since the Tories took power in 2005, and the whole foundation behind why even this bill was introduced, was this backlog. But when the Tories took power in 2005, the backlog was actually at zero, and the processing time was less than a year. Now, if you're looking at it, it's gone up to 20 months, and the backlog is in the thousands because Jason Kenney and the Conservative government refused point blank to fill in vacancies at the Immigration and Refugee Board, which is the board that hears the refugee cases. So obviously, if you refuse to fill vacancies, if you refuse to hire people on, then you're going to create a crisis and you're going to create a backlog, which is exactly what they've done. And after manufacturing the so-called crisis, they've introduced Bill C-11, and they've introduced it by saying that, you know, there's the government-assisted refugee program will be expanded over time by up to 500 places, and that they're going to so-called give another 2,000 places added to the private sponsorship of the refugee program, which is basically you can sponsor people. If you have five people that agree to sponsor you, you get sponsored into Canada. And what's actually happening is, rather than giving these so-called 2,500 places, in December of last year, what we saw was that Kenney actually cut refugee quotas from 29,000 to 12,000. And that's a cut of over 17,000. So that's more than a 60% cut. So even with this so-called 25% increase, we still are falling at a 14,500 per person cut. So there is nothing that we are being given, and this is being, you know, presented as if somehow immigrant community should be taking this as like a welcoming sign. The conservatives, and particularly Kenny, you know, really care about immigrant communities and are introducing all of this legislation to allow more and more government-assisted refugees to come in, when in fact we're seeing the opposite trend. We're seeing over a 60% cut, and these ideas of that, oh, we're giving 2,500 people more of an opportunity, are completely false, because it, at the same time, you've cut over 17,000. And also one of the other things that's happening is that the pre-removal risk assessment, which is basically the last part and your last option when you're being deported, of having someone hear your case and having any new information introduced that could stop your deportation, is being completely arbitrarily removed from the entire process. And there is nothing being put in place. There is no appeals division, despite the fact that the conservatives and the liberals alike have been promised an appeals division since 2002, when the Immigration and Refugee Protection Act came into place. We still don't see any kind of form of an appeals division. So we know they're just saying this to placate, you know, migrant community, so that we don't, you know, stand up and fight back against these changes. And one of the other things, and one of the more ominous changes of this act, is that it's for the first time establishing a list of so-called, quote-unquote, safe countries in order to kind of expedite deportations, essentially. And that what's going to end up happening is that the immigration minister, so currently Jason Kenney, has the right to deem any country safe or unsafe. And if you fall under, you know, that one of the safe countries, so it could be anywhere in the world that he deems safe, then as, you know, a refugee claimant, you have no right to an appeals division. You don't have a right to a hearing, because there is no IRB or refugee judge that can hear your case. Instead, a government-appointed civil servant will hear your case, and you have to file all of this information within 8 days of landing in Canada, and within 8 days, a decision is made about whether or not you have you can stay or whether you'll be deported. So essentially, you can have someone who comes in and files a claim, and, you know, within less than a week, they're removed without anyone that's somewhat even trained hearing their case. And basically what we're seeing is an increasingly fewer opportunities for people to gain status in any meaningful way. And really what all of these changes are highlighting, whether we're talking about like Bill C-11 or any of the larger immigration changes under Jason Kenney, is that more and more people will fall out of status. And what we're seeing that's the only thing permanent about our immigration and refugee system is that everything has become more and more temporary. And we're talking about, you know, this is the permanence of the temporary, because for the first time this year, we saw more temporary workers enter the workforce in Canada than we saw people with permanent pathways to citizenship. So we saw more and more temporary foreign workers. We saw more and more live-in caregivers. We saw more and more seasonal agricultural workers coming in, and fewer immigrants with full rights coming into the workforce. And I think it's an ominous shift within our immigration system of what's really happening is to keep people in very precarious conditions, to keep people without rights, to constantly, you know, undermine any form of labor rights that they might have, and to keep people in constant fear of detention and deportation.
Faria, thank you so much for giving us a quick look at this very grim piece of legislation that we're looking at, and of course meaning all the more reason for coming out tomorrow. That's Saturday, May the 1st, to No One Is Legal's Status for All March, and that meets at St. Jamestown at 1 p.m. tomorrow. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Okay, you're welcome.
Take care.
This has been OCAP Radio. Thank you for joining us. A quick pitch on the OCAP front as well. This Sunday, OCAP is having a Raise the Rates organizing meeting for anyone who is interested in getting involved with the Raise the Rates campaign, particularly the campaign to reintroduce a special diet, a massive cut to welfare and disability benefits that's just squirreled its way through the Ontario budget. This May the 2nd, that's Sunday, 2 p.m. at the Center for Social Justice. That's at 489 College Street, Suite 303. And always check out our website, www.ocap.ca, For more information and updates, thank you so much for listening to the show.